Well, it's gone quick for a day. let me preface this with a story about my first convert, really, in Madrid. After my failure for the first year on the campus of not getting anything happen, I got on this basketball team, this third division pro league in Spain, and began to play. And I became great friends with a guy named Bernardo. Now, it turned out almost all of the team, they'd been friends since the second grade. So I tapped in through Bernardo to this network of buddies that played basketball. And they're really, everybody was really a good ball player. We actually won the national championship in Spain in third division. And but I was so gun-shy, I had not had any success. So for a whole year with Bernardo, I hardly said anything. We just became really good friends. And we'd talk about everything, go to the movies. He actually would come over and babysit our oldest daughter, Nicole, and she loved him. She was about four at the time, and she came and asked me one time, she says, "Daddy, can I marry Bernardo?" And of course, he loved that, you know, and college student. And but anyway, I would do things for him. I gave him a book one time, but I never followed up on the book. It was a book on the gospel, and we'd talk about this and that. And he was a psychology major, and we'd talk a lot. But I was afraid to risk the relationship. We were such good friends. We'd run together, basketball. So we were getting ready to go back to the United States after 3.5 years in Madrid. And we had the Navigator European director coming in, and we were going to have a meeting, and we were going to share the gospel. And so I got enough courage to invite Bernardo to this meeting, which I'd never done, and I told him what it was. And he said, "Oh, sure, I'd love to come." And I was all excited. Well, turned out something happened, and they had to cancel the meeting to a month later. The European director couldn't come. Well, we were already going to be gone, so I told Bernardo, "I'm sorry, it's been canceled. But he's coming in another month, and you can go." "Oh, yeah." And so one of our other staff guys, I asked Jerry to call Bernardo and pick him up. And so the long story is, he came, heard the gospel, and Jerry led him to Christ. And I was so mad that I'd done all the work and didn't get to lead him to Christ. But I tell you that story is because everyone who does sowing, it's kind of like the farmer who goes out and he's never sown a crop before, and he plants his first crop and he goes out every day to see if anything's coming up. When you get a reaper, it's really hard to wait. You want something to happen, and that's the way I was with Bernardo. But because of my failure for 2.5 years, I was so nervous that I'd mess it up. So you'll go through the phase as a sower where you'll become friends, but you'll be the tar baby. You'll get mute. You won't take the risk. And so that's a good process because you have to learn to be diagnosed. So the next chart, I want to tell you a story here. The gospel network here. There we go. Now, you'll see in the center, MJ. That's a couple. We did not lead them to Christ, but we ran into them the week after they became Christians. And he came to a retreat we had, and I began to disciple him, began to help them in their marriage. In an 8-year period of time, if I could ask you a question, if 8 years from now we could come back here and through your ministry you could reach 125 people for Christ, would you think that was good or bad? In 8 years, through this couple, we saw over 125 people come to Christ. Now, how did that happen? Well, the first thing, this couple were typical of this generation. They had both been pretty wild in their youth and had partied and drugs, and he had even been in jail and all kinds of stuff, and they had lived together, and finally they got married, and somewhere in there they were struggling in their marriage, but they came to Christ. And so we ran into them, began to disciple them. Well, as they begin to grow, you see the top big white circle there, the TS. She was best friends with this couple since the second grade with the wife. So when their marriage and their life began to change in Christ, this other couple, her best friend, saw the change and said, "What's going on? And we're having trouble in our marriage." And so we ended up counseling this couple, and they came to Christ. And so then we got a little couple study, and there's the green square up at the top, the work friend. The second couple that came to Christ, a guy at work began to talk to him about his marriage troubles, and they brought him to our marriage study, and they came to Christ. And so it wasn't long before the brother down at the right, he was a lead singer in his own rock band, and he saw the change in his sister and the marriage, and he wanted to know what was going on, and he came to a little men's retreat we had with Gene Ward, by the way. Some of you know Gene. And we baptized him in the river after the conference. And then he was so excited for the Lord, his guitarist came to Christ. And then the girlfriend, and then the guitarist led his mom and dad and brother to Christ. And you can see this get went on and on. And there's two big stories in here I'd like to tell you. See the eight girlfriends up there at the top? Well, these two girls, the original M and J, the J and her girlfriend, when they came to Christ, they had these all these drinking buddies from high school, and they would hang out with them. Well, these girls saw that they both of them had become Christian, and they would get together about every 3 months for a brunch or something, and they would give them a hard time. Most of these girls were still not married and still partying and running around. But every time they'd get together, the original couple, M and Jay would come to me and say, "I just can't handle this, Doug. Every time I go, they criticize me and they attack me, attack the Bible. What do I do?" I said, "Keep hanging in there. Just be their friends. Work on sewing." So for 2 years, they would meet with them about every 2 or 3 months for a brunch. And they kept going. And finally, they decided they would do a bed and breakfast one weekend, all 10 of the girls. And so they did, and Jay was real nervous. She said, "I know this one girl's going to attack me. It's going to be a miserable weekend. I don't know how to answer. She's always negative." So she went, and they were all sitting around talking. And one of the girls said, "You know what? I've been trying to read the Bible, but I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get anything out." She asked Jay, "Would you read the Bible with me?" And she was shocked. She said, "Well, sure." And one of the other girls says, "Well, I want to read the Bible too." It ended up all eight of those girls got in a John study. Well, the interesting thing, the girl that was most negative was a lesbian. And so, of course, Jay called me and said, "Doug, you have to lead this John study." And I said, "Well, I'm not going to lead it. You're going to have to lead it." "No, no, I can't lead it. I don't know enough to lead it." "Well, I'll help you." So they led this John study. Guess who the first one to come to Christ was? The lesbian. Nobody, the most negative, no one thought she would be the first one to come to Christ, or even would come to Christ. Well, out of that, one of those girls that came to Christ, she was dating this guy, and you know, her life totally changed, and he wanted to know what was going on, so M started meeting with him, and he got into John's study, and he came to Christ. He and the girlfriend never stayed together. They broke up. But he later came to Christ, and his new girlfriend, he led her to Christ. And he's one of our most powerful guys, he and his wife reaching other couples. But you can just follow this down. The mother saw the change in her daughter. She was divorced, having a problem. Her dad was alcoholic. Her sister was a lesbian in prison, so they ended up with the sister's kids living with them. The kids came to Christ. The sister gets out of prison, living with her lesbian girlfriend, gets frustrated. She eventually comes to Christ. This took 8 years. Now, there are certain things we did to make this happen. This doesn't happen. This is not an automatic. First thing we did is we told them, "You can go to church, but don't get very involved in church right now. We want you to go into your network of your friends, and we'll help you. We'll go with you." What is the most powerful message of the gospel? A changed life. Can you argue with a changed life? There's no argument. You can say, well, it's psychological or it won't last, but you still, there's a change. There's a dark to light. When I came to Christ, all the guys on my tennis team at Oklahoma State, they would come down to my room every night for 3 weeks to argue with me. Now, I didn't know anything about the Bible, but they couldn't argue out my conversion. God had changed me. I was a different person. They could argue about the Bible wasn't true. They could argue either Christians were hypocrites. They could hit you with 100 things. But guess what they couldn't do? They couldn't get rid of my experience. And you know, individually, I didn't know enough then, but individually, each one of those guys on the tennis team said to me, you know, Doug, we admire you. We see that you're different. I'm not ready to trust Christ right now. When I'm a little older and get married, I want to become a Christian, but not right now. Well, I didn't know how to help them, but what we saw in each one of these cases, Betty and I coached them. We got involved in all of these relationships. Took 8 years, and it's still going on. I would assume this way over 150. We can't keep track of all this. I don't even try to keep track of it now. But the point is, I could give you two or three more diagrams like this, that when you begin to do a sowing ministry and you go into the networks with coaching and help with people that lives are changing, you're going to see the flow of the gospel. Just now, let me say this about the couple, M and J. This couple was not this super godly, super spiritual people. They had a lot of up and downs in their marriage originally. And they almost got a divorce the second year we were helping them over a big bunch of issues. He couldn't keep a job. He's struggling. There was just a ton of issues. But when God would work, they would keep growing. They just kept going. So I don't want to give you this picture that these were superstars. These were just normal people struggling to grow, struggling in their life and their marriage. But look what happens when you learn how to sow. Does this seem far-fetched? Does this seem impossible for you? See, we think we have to get the gospel out. We have to make this happen. We don't. God was at work in all of these people. If you get into every one of those things, a lot of those people's lives were messed up. The mom was divorced, unhappy, drank too much. She wasn't an alcoholic, but the dad was an alcoholic. The sister was in prison. You know, this other couple, their marriage was on the rock. They were struggling in their marriage. You go on and on and on. But what happens when a non-believer sees a transformed life and a change? They think, wow, there's hope. You know, if we get up and say, 25 years ago, I accepted Christ in my life and he changed it, people look at us, they don't know what we used to be like. But it's very slow when you do a sowing ministry, if you're working one-on-one, till you get the first convert or two. And in Spain, the fourth year in our student ministry, we had 55 converts, and I almost knew none of them, because it was through that third generation of connecting. So what I want to do is get into some practical things right now. Question number one, if we're not having fruit, does that mean God's not working? Absolutely not. All around us, God is working. He uses his hammer of the word, the fire of life and circumstances, the trials of, you know, God resists the proud. More people get in trouble because of their pride and their selfishness than you can imagine. So as we build relationships, if we get involved in their struggles, they'll begin to open up. When you understand the harvest, if we're dealing in a culture in America that's predominantly now not prepared, and we have to go out and, you know, pull weeds out, get the rocks out, plow the ground. What does that look like? What does it look like to be a sower and prepare the ground? I told you how long it took with my mom. I had to change. I had to get a life message. I had to begin to love her. It took time. Every person you meet where God's planted you, you can make a difference. Now, what we do on a scale of 1 to 12 on the Engel scale, how far people are from the gospel, our job in sowing is we don't have to get them from minus 12 to conversion. You can be the one that moves them from a minus 12 to a minus 9. God will use other people. So what does this look like? Some of the lessons learned we got out of all this, that the number one thing we did with M&J, we didn't focus on evangelism. We focused on their life message and their marriage and their kids. The byproduct of a changed life, if you stay with people and go into their family and friends and their network, that's where you begin to see a change. So first, there has to be a life change. Don't pull them out of their natural networks. Go with them. They need help and coach. Let me tell you the story of another couple we trained. And this guy used to be, he was on a scholarship at Southwest Texas, on a rodeo scholarship. They actually have those in Texas. You can get a scholarship to be in the rodeo. And so one of the guys on the rodeo team at Southwest with this guy was a guy named George Strait. Have you ever heard of George? Well, anyway, this guy became a Christian after his dad died and while he was in college and changed his life completely, and he got involved in the youth ministry. But after he got married, he was frustrated with the lack of fruit. So he got in a couples group with eight other couples we were training to learn how to sow and reach the lost. And for 2 years, we coached them and helped them. Nothing. They had a lot of friends, a lot of connections, no fruit. And he was frustrated. We didn't know how to get anywhere helping him. And so finally, they sold their house in San Antonio and moved out and bought a ranch at the edge of the city. And it was natural for him. He grew up on a ranch. He was a cowboy, and so he could have horses out there. And so he was really happy that he moved out there. But right away, something changed. He even led the realtor to Christ that sold him the ranch and began to meet people, neighbors. And all of a sudden, in just a short period of time, he had 8 or 10 people he led to Christ. So I met with him. I said, "What's going on? What's happening? Why do you think this has happened?" And he said to me, he says, "Oh, it's easy." He said, "I finally stopped trying to lead people to Christ and just love people." Do you hear that? Your job, my job, is not to convert people. You know, the Bible doesn't say we're to go and witness. You know what it says in Acts? Go and be a witness. Is there a difference? Yeah. Going witness is an activity. Being a witness is a life calling. Whether you intentionally are a witness or not, you are a witness. You may be the only Bible anybody reads. You are a witness. Now, I don't know if you're a good one or an average one or a bad one, but you are a witness. Now, what this young man was telling me, when he stopped trying, he just began to love people and relate to people and build relationships, and things started happening. People sensed authenticity about him and a reality and a caring. And all of a sudden, he's leading people to Christ. Well, the story is real interesting. He had offended George Strait when he became a Christian. He had preached at George, and George was very turned off. And so when he began to learn how to sow, he decided he needed to go back and talk to George and apologize to him. So I won't tell you the words he used. They were pretty strong. But he called George and said, "George, you know, I was a not a very nice person when I became a Christian to preach that. I wanted to ask your forgiveness. And he said, thanks, I really appreciate that. And so they begin to develop a relationship. And now this guy has a really good relationship with George's son. They actually rodeo together. And he's developed a real closeness with George again. George Strait lost his daughter. She was 12. She died of an accident. And so they've ministered to him. But oftentimes, I think we're too intent on an outcome that's not our job. Our job isn't to get converts. By this shall all men know that you're my disciples, if you have. How good are you at building relationships and loving people and serving people? If you would make a goal to have one couple over every 2 or 3 weeks for coffee or a meal, you know what would happen? Your life would take off. Someone said about friendship, if you aren't making new relationships all the time, you'll end up alone. The average person, the older you get, the busier you get. The average person can handle about 12 to 20 people in their network. Now, if you're my age, you've got 3 kids and 4 grandkids, and you've got staff you're working with, I'm way over 20 people. So now for me to make new non-Christian friends, I have to do it on purpose. It doesn't happen. If I open my door and don't have a plan, somebody comes in my door. How do you feel about that? Is your schedule, do you have lots of free time? I don't know anybody that does. But evangelism is not going to happen. Sowing is not going to happen unless you're intentional and you make space for new friends. How many of you from this conference would make a commitment, Doug, I'm going to make a new friend in the next 2 or 3 weeks? I'm going to go across the street to my neighbor. I might even just say hi to him before the garage door closes. That's great about American neighborhoods. You know, the most prominent feature in our neighborhoods is front of our houses is our garage door. You know, real beckoning for friendship. But if you can get Americans away from their video games and their cell phones and their TV and keep their garage door open, you might have time. It's going to take some initiative. Betty and I sat down and we were pretty disturbed about 6 months ago, and we said, you know what? We've gotten ourselves surrounded by Christians again. Happens regularly. So we made a list of 10 potential networks where we could meet people. And it's so fun again. We joined the Y. Betty's had some back problems, and so we decided that it would be good if she could get to the Y and get into yoga classes. So I agreed to join her. And hey, listen, don't laugh. Don't be smart. I tell you what, the first yoga class I went to, I was the only one that couldn't do it. All these women were doing it perfectly, you know, and I was falling. It is hard. But you know, the second session at the Y, after it was over with, I started talking to this young gal. She asked me why coming so early. It's 6 a.m. It was crazy. So we started talking, found out she was in the Army and just gotten out of the Army and been in Iraq in combat as a combat medic. We started talking, opened up her life. She was getting ready to move to Seattle, but she was so needful for direction in her life. You just meet new people. Let me give you an assignment we do in our training. Your assignment this week is to meet a new person. How hard is that? I helped coach a guy in California, and he'd read my newsletters, and he'd call me, Doug, what can I do to reach the lost? What do I do? And so we talked many times on the phone. I'm finally trying to help him find a network. He says, well, there's only 2 things in my life that are consistent. He had 8 daughters, by the way. That's kind of That tells you how busy he was. He said, I read my Bible every day and I have to have coffee. And I said, well, where do you get your coffee? Well, it's a kind of Starbucks-like place. I have to have it. I go there at least 4 days a week. He travels. He had a carpet business. So I said, well, maybe you make that your network. Well, he jumped on that. He would go at 5:30 in the morning to this Starbucks-like place, and he would sit there for an hour and take his book and read and talk to people. And he'd stay till 6:30 when the yuppies would come in. And so the older folks come in at 5:30, the yuppies at 6:30. Well, I went out a couple of years ago to visit him. I spoke at a NAV conference in California, and I went down and spent a couple of days with Tom. We went to this Starbucks. He must have known over 100 people there. The 5:30 group, after about a year, he got a group in a John study, and people came to Christ. The 6:30 group, he got a John study going. They came to Christ. He knew everybody. He only had two constants, Bible and quiet time and coffee. Well, he found a niche, a network. Now, he's an outgoing people person. What am I telling you here? If you want to start sowing, you have to meet new people. You have to build relationships. Don't try to conquer the world. Don't try to reach the world for Christ. Start by just connecting. Have fun. We helped this couple, Brad and Robin, and they were both off the charts, skilled people, persons. They both were gifted relationally, and he was an executive, and we started training them. And so they began to reach out in their network and do things, and they invited us to their Christmas party. They had 50 couples at their Christmas party. And it was the most elaborate, cool party you've ever seen. I mean, they were really good. Well, after a while and all this networking, Robin calls me and said, Doug, we've talked to a lot of these people and we've asked them if they want to study John with us. And 15 couples say they want to. What do I do? We can't do 15 couples. And I said, Robin, you know Americans, 15 aren't going to show up. Just invite and see who comes. There'll probably half that many won't come. And so the first Friday night they had the John study. About 10:30, I called over there. I was dying to know what happened. And I answered the phone. She said, Doug Benchoff, you lied. I said, what? She said, all 15 of them came. What are we going to do with 30 people? You know. What's the point? They were gifted in relationally, but they begin to network and make new friends. You can do this. You don't have to go very far. So what I want to do now is I want to spend the next few minutes just letting you all ask questions. You know, you've heard the motivation, the stories, the pictures. Now, what are the hindrances or the things that impair you or that are obstacles for you? What could you do to get this sowing started in your life? So, David, you want to help us? So if you have a question or anything, we'll field it. So we'll take about 10 or 12 minutes here and just let you have the floor.
When you're in like the coffee shop or YMCA or something like that, how do you get past just the high to want to come to a John study?
So you're in a coffee shop and you're sitting there having coffee and you meet hi to somebody. Well, is that the next step, Bible study? How long would it take normally, you think, if you're in a coffee shop and you say hi to someone to build a relationship? Your goal isn't a Bible study. Relax. It's not a Bible study. Greet them. Hi, how you doing? I see you're here last week. You come every day. You start talking. What do? You just start what? Being a friend. Relate. Don't try to have a goal. Don't even have an agenda. Just get to know them. Ask them questions. And you know what? They'll start talking. The next time she comes in and she sees you there, what will she do? Hi, Pam. How are you? Oh, how are you doing? What's going on? By the third, fourth, fifth time you meet them, there's a comfort level suddenly. They'll come up and sit with you, or you get there, they're already there, you go sit with them. Don't hurry it. Just develop a relationship. Does that make sense? Now, as you do diagnosis, if you keep asking these questions, how's it going, what's happening in your life, they'll start opening up and tell you more when there's a confidence. So you don't have to get anywhere. If it takes you 6 months, don't worry about it. Some people are very open. You meet some people and they'll tell you everything. And some people, 6 months, they won't even hardly tell you they're married or have kids. They're very guarded. So relax, you know. Another question.
That was worth watching you run.
What about the culture when you went to Spain? Did you have any problems adjusting to the culture differences? What kind of differences were there?
Boy, God, you know, God, what's your name?
Don.
Don, God knows what he's doing. I was thrown in Spain. It fit me perfectly. I couldn't shut up. They can't shut up. You know, we had a couples retreat one time with a bunch of young couples, and we were all camping. And I was on the way to brush my teeth and shave in the morning, and I saw these six Spanish men standing, talking. And they were all talking at once. And so in our little workshop that morning, it was on communication. So I thought I'd be all brilliant, and I told the Spaniards, now, here's an example of bad communication. These six men were all talking at once. Now, what's the problem with that? And somebody raised their hand and says, well, at least they got to express themselves. So that was Spain. I loved it. You could always get a conversation in Spain about anything. The Spaniards loved to be together. They loved to talk. They loved to eat. So for me, I found home. So some people did have an adjustment problem in Spain, but Betty and I, we felt like we were being punished when we went back to America. So I was a little different. We loved Spain. It fit us.
You've talked about the John studies a lot. Could you maybe kind of give us a little bit more detailed explanation? What's a John study? What is it the same as a regular Bible study? What's specific about it compared to a regular believer Bible study? Maybe some thoughts on that.
Yeah, first of all, it's a misnomer. It's not a Bible study. I don't know why we started calling it a John study. It's a Bible reading. We read the Gospel of John with a non-Christian. And what the material I have is actually, we've gone through every chapter in John, and we've come up with a series of questions that help people go through the study. And there's only two questions we're trying to answer with the non-Christian. Who is Jesus, and what does he want with us? Every person has an idea who Jesus is. They know the Easter story or Christmas story, but they don't have a clue what he wants. And so what we do is we read the Gospel of John a chapter a week with a non-believer. And then we don't hand out anything. We memorize the questions, and we ask the questions that we go through. In John 20:30, it says that the author John says, I've written these so that you might believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God. There's proof in every chapter of who Jesus is. There's evidence in every single chapter. And what the study I have shows you is just how to lead the discussion. So it's a Bible reading rather than a study. It's great. You know, we usually ask them to make a commitment of 6 weeks, go through the first five chapters. We divide chapter one into two sections. But yeah, what I could do is if you want on my mailing list, or you want the study, if you will take this down, I'll give you my email, and you can email me, Doug, I would be interested in the John study, or I'd like on your mailing list. It's dbenshoff, B-E-N-S-H-O-O-F, @satx.rr.com. San Antonio, Texas. dbenchoff@satx.rr.com. And just, you know, because I'm older and my memory is not good, just tell me who you are and you were at the conference and you would like to be on our mailing list or like the study, and I'll email it to you. .rr.com. Roadrunner, that's what it stands for, RR. Okay? Now,
I have a question, Doug.
Don't print these out and hand them out. That's one of my conditions. Don't give this questions to people. Just read the Bible, and you memorize the questions, and you ask the question. Make it where you're sitting alongside the person reading the Bible with them. You're not a class trying to teach them the Bible. You're trying to help them discover.
I have a question. If you develop a relationship with a person and you try to enter into a spiritual area with them at the appropriate time, and they really rebuff you, really hold you off, there's a tendency on our part to think, well, I've really blown it now, you know, and kind of afraid to go there again.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on how to re-enter that or how to continue the relationship without messing it up?
Yeah, and it's back to this friendship. You'll know when you have a friendship with someone that it's reciprocal. They'll call you, they'll invite you for dinner, they'll want to be with you. And you'll begin to be really comfortable with them as they are with you and you with them. This couple in Madrid, our neighbors, it got to be they were too comfortable. They'd have a huge fight in the car. We're going somewhere, and they get in a big fight and yelling at each other in the car. You know, like, you want us to leave? No, that's all right. So they got so comfortable, they could be themselves right in front of us. So part of your measuring stick is not your objective to talk to them about spiritual things. Can you talk to them about life first? Can you tell your struggles and your story? Will they tell you their struggles in their life? What can you talk about with friends, if they're really your friends? Anything. Now, if spiritual things don't come up in the relationship over time, there's some things we've done, like, you'll say to the person, you know, we've become friends, right? You like me, yeah. But you know, there's part of my life we've never talked about. There's something really important to me that's a central part of who I am. And I've never gotten a chance to talk to you about the importance of the spiritual things in my life and my relationship to Christ. I'd like to talk to you about that sometime. You know, sometimes they may be a non-confrontational person and they're kind of waiting. They're watching. They're not going to bring it up. Some people will bring it up. So you say, can I have your permission? Can we talk about that sometime? And most of the time, if they're a friend, they say, sure. Or you may ask them, you know, what's your spiritual background? What, you know, did you grow up in a church? Do you have any spiritual interests? You know, you begin to get information for them. You know, and I've had people tell me, I'm not interested in spiritual things. And, you know, that's a bunch of junk. And I said, well, what do you mean by that? Are you against church or Christians or the Bible or Jesus? Well, no, I don't have any problem with Jesus. It's just I think Christians are hypocrites. Well, have you ever met a Christian or you thought it was a real Christian? So you just keep going there to find out where the line of departure is. And so you keep probing. If they say, no, I don't want anything to do with this, you know, there's still, you may have to move them on the back burner, but you still keep doing things with them. If they want to be your friend, you know, and a lot of times I look at it this way. A lot of professionals, particularly in America, they feel pretty good about themselves. They think they've got their life together and everything's going well and they're making money. But we can be there when the crisis comes, and it will. What do we know? We know that a non-Christian cannot make his life work without Jesus. It's not going to happen. We know that, guaranteed. Any non-Christian you know, no matter how good they're going, Isaiah 57, 20 and 21 says, the wicked are like the sea that toss up mire and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, for the wicked. Now, what do we know? There are some wicked people, some non-Christians, they have a crack in their life you could drive a Mack truck in. It's obvious they're messed up. There's a lot of people driving Beamers that make $100,000 a year. They look uptight. They look perfect on the outside. But you don't know what's going on in their marriage, in their life, or their work. And I helped a couple one time. They were both maxed out each on 8 credit cards each. When she'd get depressed, she'd go to Walmart and buy. Well, they were yuppies. They looked good. He had a good job. She had a good job. They were miserable. So as we developed a relationship, they will hit the wall. So maybe you have to move this relationship on a back burner. They're not ready. That's not your job to get them ready. Just be their friend. But you know what? When they hit trouble, they'll remember us. They'll come. I've gotten a phone call late at night from somebody I haven't talked to in 2 years. Hey, Doug, you got time for breakfast? What's going on? We got some problems. Can we talk? You know. So don't make the first response if it's negative. Oftentimes, there's another thing. A lot of times the people that are closest to needing God are the ones that will give you the hardest time. Sometimes people will come at you really hard. I don't believe in that crap. Don't judge that response to what's going on in their heart and in their lives. Be careful that you don't react. They may just stiff arm you. That's what I did with my friend John, but I watched him a whole year. So don't take the first stiff arm or the first reaction as they're done. They're really watching you a lot closer than you think they are. They're observing you. They want to know if you're authentic. Maybe somebody else has preached at them and they didn't like that, but they'll watch and see what you do. Does that make sense? Don't give up if that first response is negative. Keep being their friend. Anybody else over here?